over the last week, one of the groups spearheading international intervention in occupied Palestine, the Christian Peacemaker Teams, has come under the target of the Israeli Defense Forces in recent days. There was a Canadian member who was arrested and is still under threat of deportation as he's currently detained by the Israeli Defense Forces. And joining us on the line to talk about this situation facing the CPT is Rich, who's joining us on the phone from the United States, and Chris, who's on the line from Occupied Palestine. Welcome both to the program.
Thank you.
Rich, could you begin by giving us some background on the CPT? How long has the Christian Peacemaker Team been in Palestine? And as we understand it, you and your organization have actually spearheaded international intervention in the territories.
It's clear that we're one of a number of groups, and both international and Israeli peace groups are coming under increased pressure. I received a note today that Arik Asherman, head of Rabbis for Human Rights, was called in for questioning by the military yesterday. So it is not just international groups that are being challenged in their human rights monitoring. It includes Israeli peace groups. The background. Christian Peacemaker Teams began over a decade ago, a movement among Christians who felt that there was a reason to put their bodies on the line the same way soldiers do in nonviolent intervention for violence reduction. Early efforts of Christian Peacemaker Teams in Chiapas in southern Mexico, in Haiti during a coup, and other places gave us a sense that while we don't have all the answers, this is one tool that really works. And so we have been supporting small teams, 6 to 8 members of Christians committed to nonviolence through nonviolent intervention in situations of lethal intergroup conflict. Our invitation to Hebron from June of 95, we began working there with an invitation from the mayor of Hebron, who had heard about what CPT had done in Haiti. Hebron is an unusual case, even in an unusual land. In Hebron, the immediate proximity of settlers, Israeli settlers, who are confiscating land and trying to expand a presence in the occupied territories, immediate proximity, next door to each other in row houses to Palestinians in a city of 130,000 Palestinians. The tension from this close proximity, unlike most settlements, which are on agricultural land a kilometer or two away from an Arab village. In Hebron, the Palestinians and the settlers are next-door neighbors. There are 3 or 4 small Israeli settlements in the middle of Hebron that include perhaps 300 settlers in total, and there are 1,500 Israeli soldiers there to protect them. Palestinian school kids have to walk past these settlements between home and school. Palestinian shopkeepers have shops directly across the street from these settlements. That's the context that makes Hebron an unusually tense city in the West Bank. We were invited there by the mayor of Hebron. We began an accompaniment presence similar to what Peace Brigades International has pioneered in many places around the world. Simply the fact that the eyes of the world, represented by some international peacemakers, everyone behaves better when they're being watched. It just works to have an international presence monitoring and, in cases of human rights abuse, intervening. That seems only reasonable.
Now, Rich, you had mentioned that you had come into Hebron at the invitation of the mayor, but this was also in the midst of a peace process which had divided the city of Hebron, one half of the city being under Palestinian control and the other half under Israeli control. Can you talk about the work of the CPT in dealing with that division and the realities of life in Hebron?
Yes. Now, in fact, we began June of 95 in Hebron with walking school kids to school was our initial on-the-street work. The Hebron Accords were signed in January of 97, a year and a half after that, and that was the beginning of that was the division of Hebron into an H1. H1 was an area then that under the Oslo process was Palestinian-controlled sector, 80% of the city, and the other 20% of the city, the old city and where the settlements are and the old business district, and the historic section where the Tomb of the Abraham and Sarah is located. This section, H2, it was called, was put under direct Israeli control in the division of Hebron in those Hebron Accords. Now, that created then a set of barriers of checkpoints around Hebron separating H2, the Israeli-controlled sector, from H1, the Palestinian-controlled sector. Our apartment and our presence is primarily in H2, in the Israeli-controlled sector where the settlements are located. In that work, then, we had three parts of our work. If you want a simple version of what CPT does, the first part is the street presence, accompaniment, monitoring. The second part of our work is supporting local peacemakers. We look for Israeli peacemakers and Palestinian peacemakers anywhere we find them, and we ask them, what can we do to help? What can we do to support you? And so we've discovered that there are Israeli peacemakers and Palestinian peacemakers glad for our support, and we consider them to be useful advisors to help us know what we should be doing. The third part of our work, then, is reporting, telling what we see. It doesn't do much good for the world's eyes to be there if their mouths are shut. So we do interviews like this. We write releases. We come home and visit churches and tell what we have seen and participated in. We talk about the Israeli peace groups and how hard they're working. We talk about the lives of Palestinians in Hebron. And we talk about what we have done in the last few months when we tell our stories. So that storytelling seems to be really very important because North American foreign policy is a big player in terms of what will or won't happen. Roadmap, Oslo, whatever process you're talking about, we think opinion of North Americans conveyed through their governments does matter. So there are the three parts of what we've been doing, and our work has been fairly consistent since the beginning in 1995. Although early on we discovered what a serious problem home demolitions had become. Home demolitions, demolitions of Palestinian homes, either because they were located where an Israeli bypass road, settler-only bypass road, was going to be built, or because they were located near a settlement, or for a variety of other reasons, many, many of the demolitions, the vast majority, had no connection to any terrorism or any punishment or any security. They were land confiscation and harassment. And so we began a focus on home demolitions during the late 90s to just draw attention to how many Palestinians were living in fear that their homes would be demolished. That got us out of Hebron a little more. And so now, having had a team there for the past 8 years, we have a lot of friends in Hebron and in Israel and in Palestine that we try to keep up with. There's some background for you about what CPT is doing.
We're talking with Rich, who's on the phone from the United States, about the Christian peacemaker teams and their activities in Hebron. The peacemakers have this week come under the attention of the Israeli Defense Forces. I guess since 1995, you've been working in Hebron, and Chris is there now. And Chris, I'd like you to share with our listeners what has happened in the last week, and tell us your thoughts on why the Israeli Defense Forces is so interested in groups working for peace in Palestine.
Certainly. Well, as of tomorrow will be 1 week that we experienced a suicide bombing here in the Old City in a settlement known as Abraham Avinu, which is not too far away from the CPT Hebron apartment. At about 7:10 last week, there was a tremendous explosion outside, which all of us had heard. We had raced up to our roof and had seen black smoke emanating up into the sky. Settlers, soldiers, police, ambulances came from everywhere, scrambling towards the settlement. It was the other chaos and panic that you'd see on the evening news that they show when they show that scene, which was something I don't think I'll forget anytime soon. At that point, we knew that there was going to be a tight closure on the old city. We were expecting repercussions from that suicide bombing. As Rich had said, we go out on school patrol 6 days a week here in the old city, and we had planned on going out on Sunday morning, which five of us did. We were walking through the maze of the old city and came across a platoon of soldiers who told us that there was a curfew on, that there was going to be no school, and they promptly asked us to turn around and go back home. At that stage, myself, Greg, who was also going out on school patrol that day, and two other women had decided that we were going to go into the H1 area of Hebron. As Richard mentioned, we live in H2. And we proceeded up to H1. And when we got there, we were told by one of our Palestinian friends that there were several men being detained at a checkpoint known as Beit Hadassah checkpoint. And myself and Greg and two other ladies went up there to observe. And when we got there, Greg and I volunteered to stay to see how the situation would unfold. As Rich said, we do a lot of monitoring of checkpoints and those things, and it is true that when we are present, or when human rights workers and peace workers are present, it does change the attitude of the soldiers. We found that through numerous times. But on this day, the soldiers asked us to come forward and present our IDs. Both myself and Greg had presented our CPT ID, which is our custom. We don't present our passports unless we're strongly demanded to show our passports. We showed our CPT ID, and after a moment, the soldier asked us to show our passports. I had presented mine. Greg presented a photocopy of his passport, which is a valid thing to do. And at that point, a soldier told us, well, you know, I just spoke with my commander, and the two of you will have to be detained with the Palestinians, and you'll need to go over and sit down with them. And we had replied, we had no intention on leaving until you release the Palestinians anyway. We'll be glad to do that. So over the next 3 hours, we were there with these Palestinian men. It grew from 9 people to about roughly 36. And during that time, both myself and Greg were asking that the men be allowed to have water, that they were allowed to have cigarettes, and that they were allowed to sit in the shade. And we constantly said that the Fourth Geneva Convention stipulated that an occupying army must make sure that a person being detained is comfortable in the time of their detention. And after about 3 hours, and we had arrived there at 8 o'clock in the morning, and about 11 o'clock, I had noticed that there was a policeman who had approached one of the soldiers. And at that point, I realized that Greg and I were going to be arrested. You do not need a policeman, a regular policeman, to arrest Palestinians, only internationals. And so that's when I was assuming that he and I were going to be arrested. They summoned us over, and we stood near this wall, and they handed me back my passport and CPT ID and had informed Greg that he was under arrest. And we both inquired why he was under arrest, and they had said that he was interfering with a soldier's duty to do his job. And I had reiterated that I was doing the exact same thing. Why am I not being arrested? This sounds very suspicious to me. And they essentially told me to just keep moving on, that there was nothing that I could do about it. This was what was going to happen. And that was the last time physically I have seen Greg, which has been roughly 5 days now. And that is currently the situation that he is in Romney Prison just outside of Jerusalem, and is hopefully going to be allowed to have a hearing to question this non-existent charge. And by the way, they have not charged him with anything. He is just sitting in prison right now, not being charged, which is, of course, completely illegal.
Now, the word that came across the newswire yesterday from Hebron was that Greg was in jail without charge, facing deportation. Is that threat still there, and has there been any communication between Greg and his family here in Canada?
To my knowledge, that his family is aware that he is in Romney Prison. CPT does a very good job during crisis moments to inform the family in a proactive and productive way, and they have been kept informed since things have been happening since last Sunday. In regards to the charge, yes, you are correct. He has not been charged with anything, which, you know, once again tells me that they don't really have any basis for holding him, and he should be released immediately. And at this present point in time, our lawyers are working on getting him released and hopefully bringing him before the High Court in order to that he might be able to have a hearing.
Now, that High Court hearing will depend on when the Israeli military responds to the petition. And so it could be up to a month before he would have a hearing. And we're hoping that he'll be released without conditions in the meantime. Gretchen, it would be useful perhaps for your listeners to have the email address or fax number of the Israeli Minister of Interior. That would be the official who could release Greg on his own recognizance. And that would be the man who should answer the question, what does this crackdown on, what does this set of restrictions on international human rights observers mean? So I'd be glad to give you that email address and fax number if you want to give that over the air.
Yeah, I would be more than happy to, and then I'd like to get your response to that question of what does this crackdown mean for internationals working in Palestine?
Yes, well, let me first of all give this email address. And the Minister of the Interior is a man named Avraham Poraz, P-O-R-A-Z. And he sees himself as a liberal, democratic politician, and I think he is open to questions about what kind of policies he's enforcing here. His email is his initial, A, and his last name, Poraz, A-P-O-R-A-Z, at knesset.gov.il, Knesset, K-N-E-S-S-E-T, .gov.il. So that would be emailed to the Israeli Minister of Interior. His fax number, dialed from North America, 011 for international, 972 for Israel, 2 for the Jerusalem area, 566-6376. I'll read that again. From North America, 011-972-2-566-6376. That would be faxed to the Minister of Interior. Now, the note I received this morning from an Israeli rabbi made a reference to the seeing eye, the concept that even when we try to do things in secret, God is watching, God sees, and I sees. The attempt to restrict where human rights observers can walk and watch and where Israeli humanitarian groups can visit Palestinian friends seems to us to be an attempt to prepare to do things in secret. And we have no grand theory of what is being prepared. We just see the attempt to remove observers as a red flag. And so we would suggest that this is an important time for people to contact the Minister of Interior, Avraham Poraz, and ask him the questions. What does it mean that your government is making efforts to remove people who are doing nothing more aggressive than watching and reporting?
Now, Chris, you're there in Hebron, and over the last couple of nights, there have also been visits to the CPT offices by IDF soldiers. Have those visits stopped?
Currently, yes, they have. The soldiers came to our apartment for the first time on Monday at about 4 p.m. They had searched the apartment. They did not take anything. These soldiers are ones that we have dealt with now since February. At that time, Rich had also come to work with us for a month, also being the leader of a delegation. Many of these soldiers are actually from kibbutzes, as well as their left-leaning young men who actually are really torn towards working here in the occupied territories. And it was ironic when they were here, they kept on apologizing profusely, saying, "I'm sorry, I have to do this, I have to do this, I'm sorry, I'm sorry." And you could tell that they were torn about having to search the house. And it took them about an hour or so, and they promptly left after that. And the next night, another group of soldiers showed up. Six soldiers showed up the first day at 4 p.m., and then the next night at about 8:20, about eight soldiers showed up, also were fairly cordial, but did not search us. They came directly to our offices and said, "This is what you need to understand. You are not allowed in H1, that is Palestinian-controlled. Only internationals can be in H2, which is Israeli-controlled. This is for your own safety." I had replied that I felt more comfortable in H1 amongst Palestinians than I ever have in H2, where I'm constantly threatened by soldiers as well as settlers. And the commander of the unit looked on me surprised, and he went on and said, "If we do find you in H1, we will arrest you, and you might face the same fate as your friend who is currently sitting in prison right now." And my understanding of that was, "You're planning on trying to deport us? Is that my understanding?" And he said, "I'm just telling you, you cannot be in H1. Also, underneath that banner, we have received conflicting information. We were told that we are allowed to be in the H2 area, even during curfew, by one platoon of soldiers, and then another platoon will say, "No, you're not allowed to be out during curfew in H2, only when there is no curfew." And one group of soldiers has recently told us that you are allowed to go up to H1 to get food, and another group would tell us, "No, you cannot go up to H1 under any circumstances." So there is a lot of misinformation going around, and we have constantly been requesting information in written form in English from the district command office here in the Hebron district. As of yet, we have not received that. So at this time, there's a lot of conflicting information that's floating around, and it's making it hard to understand who is telling us the truth and who is not. But in my opinion, this is one of the games that the Israeli army plays, not only with Palestinians but also with internationals. They're trying to always trick somebody up in order to say that, okay, now you're under arrest or now we can deport you.
I would hazard a guess that the searching of the apartment by soldiers was related to Greg sitting and facing detention, deportation. My guess is that they were looking to see if they could find anything in the apartment that would be useful, incriminating evidence to argue that he had done something or was part of a group that mm-hmm. held beliefs such that he should be deported. And they didn't find anything.
Well, the larger issue here, though, is why the sudden attention on the CPT. Rich, you had mentioned that the work had been done there since 1995. And I just wanted to pose that question to Chris, who's there in Hebron now, who's working in occupied Palestine. You had began the story of Greg's legal detention with Sunday's suicide bombing. But just 2 weeks prior, there had been a raid on the International Solidarity Movement's offices as well. So it sort of seems that this crackdown on peace groups in Palestine goes beyond Sunday's suicide bombing.
No, that's certainly, you're absolutely right, Gretchen. The Israeli government, especially the Minister of Defense, has made no secret of his disdain for peace activists. He has often said that he wants us out. Of course, ISM is in the spotlight, with the deaths of Rachel Khoury and the shooting of Brian Avery and Tom Herndahl. That has even stepped it up more of them saying, well, you see all these peace activists, they are endangering their own lives, they're endangering Palestinian lives, and they're endangering the lives of Israeli military. That is their excuse that they're using. And with that, they have, decided that they are going to raid the offices of the ISM to find incriminating evidence against them. And with the suicide bombing, it just gave them an opportunity to say, now we can make our move on CPT. Because I think that you, and Rich has said this, I'm sure, when he was given the history of, we are a disciplined group, we are a smaller group, and we are based here in Hebron, whereas ISM is in Qalqilya, Karkarim, Nablus, Jenin, Rafah, all these areas. It's difficult to find them for two reasons. Number one, they're placed all around, but also number two, they have people coming in for 2 weeks, sometimes 3 months, sometimes, a year or so. So you never know exactly who they are. And the other thing is we're more identifiable than they are because we do have a little bit of a uniform that we always have, most notably a red hat that we have that says CPT on it. But I do believe that with the suicide bombing that recently occurred, that was one way that they could start stepping up the pressure on trying to remove CPT. And one of the ways that's most effective is just to say, this is now a closed militarized zone. And as an international, under Israeli law, you are not allowed to be in a closed militarized zone if you're an international. It's fine for a Palestinian, but not for you.
The underlying question might be, is the observation and the reporting of what peace groups and human rights monitors see and observe, is this becoming a bigger embarrassment to the Israeli government? I think the answer there is that it is, that the Israeli government is behaving with less care for what the world says and sees, but they are still, the Israeli government is still embarrassed when blatant human rights violations or violations of international law are reported.
Well, Rich and Chris, I want to thank you both very much for joining us and talking about the work of the CPT, but also the pressure that's facing many international peace groups in the territories. Thank you both again for joining us on today's program.
Anyone interested in more information on CPT could check out our website, www.cpt.org.
Thanks again, Chris.
Thank you, Gretchen.
Thank you very much, Gretchen.
Thanks, Rich. Bye-bye.
Bye.